Hello, and welcome to the Back Issue Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer.
In this episode, we'll be having a spoiler-filled discussion about an older comic book storyline.
In this Back Issue Spotlight, I'm joined by Sam, and we're going to be discussing the original Spider-Man Clone Saga, or at least the first part of it, covering Amazing Spider-Man issues 144 to 147 from 1975. Sam, how you doing tonight?
I am wonderful, John. How are you?
I am doing well. Now, I'm going to start out by saying, again, I am not all that familiar with this era of Spider-Man. Not too long ago, we discussed, was it Amazing Spider-Man 121, 122 with the death of Gwen Stacy?
Mm-hmm.
That was from 1973.
Yeah, and the death of Green Goblin.
Oh, yeah. He died. A lot of people were dying. It was a bad year. Now, I'm going to fess up. I have not read the 21 issues between that and this, but comic stories back then were fairly accessible. I'm not too worried about it. Because let's face it, back in those days, they'd spend a page almost every issue, it seemed like, recapping the relevant stuff. Because not everyone could find everything on the spinner rack.
Yeah, and I don't think there's a lot of... Peter makes a trip to Europe after this, which is kind of a weird story. There's a couple of one-shots, basically. I think where we left off to here is a perfect, you know... I don't think you've missed anything that's needed.
Well, and again, they were expecting more casual readers back then. And anything that I needed to know, they tend to give me.
Exactly.
Which is fundamentally different than a lot of writers today.
Yes, it is.
Now, I will say, I was a little surprised when this issue started and Peter was in Paris.
Like I said, he goes to Europe. Yep.
So, and I'm like, because if they hadn't actually told me, oh, you know, we're in Paris or something, it's like on that title page, it could have been New York for all I could tell.
Yep.
But, you know, as they are wont to do at the time... You know, the lead character thinks a lot about what's going on in the then and now, you know, and, you know, his thought balloons gave me everything I needed to know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we should mention, again, with how important this story became in the 90s, and I mean, still having ramifications today, we should mention Jerry Conway wrote this,
And
it was edited by Len Wein, which is interesting because by the time this kind of ends, Len Wein takes over as the writer on the book.
Yeah, at the last one of these, I think when we get to 151 next time, he was writer and editor.
That is correct, yep.
Which I always find a little bit weird, but, you know, okay. I think there should be a separation of duties for that, because I think you need a second set of eyes on the story.
I'm trying to remember how long that lasts. It's not that long. I believe he gets another editor fairly quickly, and then, of course, lends off to DC before too long.
Mm-hmm. And he did quite a bit over there. Well, and this is back in the era when creators would, I don't want to say literally walk across the street or whatever, but they would bounce between the two companies a lot more than they tend to now.
Yes. Well, and it didn't, other than Jack Kirby, I don't remember it being as big a deal as it tends to be these days.
I think it comes down to which company the creator is kind of most associated with, and not every creator gets that hardcore of a tie to a particular one.
Yeah, that is true.
Obviously, Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, you think Marvel.
Yeah, and like I said, DC at the time made a big deal about it when Kirby came over.
I think it was a huge deal. He was one of the founding fathers over at Marvel.
The next time I remember it being a big deal with creators kind of changing was obviously when the Image guys left. That was a huge deal.
I was going to say John Byrne.
And then, exactly, John Byrne.
When he took over Superman.
From, I feel like such an
Kurt
idiot.
Kurt Swan.
And, you know, they made such a big deal about it and did that whole ceremony at Comic-Con with Swan handing him the pencil and the whole thing, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, let's face it, if Marvel had snagged Bob Kane or Julie Schwartz, even as an editor and stuff.
Yeah, Julie Schwartz or Carmine Infantino, if either of them had gone to Marvel,
yeah,
it would have been a big deal.
So, it's funny, because I really associate both Len Wein and Jerry Conway more with DC than Marvel, knowing they worked a lot at both.
Yeah, they really did. Well, I mean, Len Wein, it's amazing. I mean, in not too long of a period, he essentially creates Wolverine and the Swamp Thing.
Yeah.
And I think that's within like a year and a half period.
Yeah, among a number of other characters.
Absolutely.
He was there at the beginning of the new X-Men.
Yep.
You know, back when it was the first The New X-Men.
Yep.
You know, it's funny because this story is so iconic for the look and feel I expect out of, you know, early Spider-Man. Not early, but you know what I mean. Spider-Man of the Bronze Age or whatever. And you could argue where the Bronze Age exactly starts, but still.
Absolutely. And it's interesting. It does, I mean, I got to admit, I'm not particularly familiar with the artist on this era, which was Ross Andrew. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Do you have anything to add there? Because I don't really.
He feels like a signature style for Spider-Man and Marvel to a degree.
He does.
He's one of those guys, though, that as much as he didn't get the name cachet or whatever that some others have.
No.
And I'm not sure why, because, I mean, he's doing a great job.
Well, and it's funny, when we mentioned that we were doing this issue on, I don't remember if it was the forum or Slack.
It was on Slack.
Somebody mentioned, oh, that's, are those the Romita issues? And I'm like, no, actually, Ross Andrew did these.
That was Brawlinator who asked
it.
It
was
that,
Chris, yeah. And yeah, it's one of those things, when you think of Spider-Man artists, it's not a name that people remember or come up with, but you see, A, the sizable chunk, and it's a very recognizable classic Spider-Man look.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm not well-versed enough in Spider-Man to know where I would put some of the dividing lines. Certainly one major mile marker for the character was getting the black costume with Secret Wars.
Which is quite a bit later.
Yeah, it's over 100 issues later.
Yeah.
But I would say this is, somewhere in this era, is a turning point from the early days when it was always the first appearance of this, that, or the other, or the second or third of this, that, or the other villain and such, to some of these guys have been around the block, they've fought a number of times, and it's kind of old hat to bring them back.
Well, it is. And, you know, I think that's why it's good we kind of started where we did. Obviously, you could go back to the Ditko stuff and really see the origins. Mm-hmm. But for Gwen Stacy and Norman Osborn to both be dead was a big deal and a major change for this character.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've taken two major supporting cast characters out of play.
Yeah. You know, like you mentioned, we covered that a few episodes back. And like I said, there's this trip to Europe and there's a few other things that happen, but nothing major. I've got to ask, because I know you're a big fan, as am I, of kind of the clone saga from the early 90s. Mm-hmm. Had you read this at that point?
No, I was familiar with the high points of this story, but I'm not even positive I've read it prior to reading it for this episode.
Okay. Yeah, and I'm in the same boat. I was reading the Clone Saga as it was, you know, buying it off the rack, and I was completely unaware of this story. And I probably first read it, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, but it was certainly long after that.
But at this point in comics, even into the early 80s and such, there were things like later the Handbook of the Marvel Universe or the Marvel Saga or some of the reprint titles they were doing.
Yep.
And between those things and the fairly ubiquitous flashbacks and reminiscing about past events, you knew about these things even if you hadn't read about these things.
Yeah.
And there's an aspect of that which I think is totally lost in modern comics.
Yeah.
You're just expected to know these things, whereas these creators would give you enough, even if it's just, we're going to devote a page, it's going to be a montage piece of art, we're going to be enough captions to kind of give you the clue of the relevant parts of the last 6 months worth of stories that you got to know for this one or something.
Yeah. And I believe it was Bob Wells at the time of the newer Clone Saga used like half of the letters pages to not do a previously on, but kind of go back and give some of the history, which I remember at the time being really helpful.
Yeah, letters pages, both in terms of the actual letters or when they would just do text pieces like that.
Yeah.
Huge help. Well, I mean, when we were going through the Shazam stuff,
and
they would have those one pages on, here's some of his supporting cast, here's what the gods are, here's what the acronym stands for.
Yeah.
Those are the sorts of things that makes comics accessible.
Yeah.
And there was a point at which they were doing that all the time, and it's like, okay, maybe a little overkill, and other times where it's like dropped entirely. But there was a point, and I think late 70s, early 80s is where they had enough to get you up to speed on what you needed to know, but not belabor it and have characters telling you things or speaking things, thinking things they already know for the sake of telling us.
Yeah.
You know, I remember every time the annual JLA-JSA crossover would come up, there'd be that typical one page where you'd have, you know, there are two Earths with a different vibration, and you'd have, you know, the Flash and the Golden Age Flash, you know, and the different characters to get the sense of, oh, JLA's here, JSA's there kind of a thing.
Yep.
That one page had, you know, oodles of different variants of it, but essentially that same functional page, if not literal page, was, you know, printed so many times that, you know, it's a go-to thing. It's like in the X-Men, you know, when they would have the X-Men going into action, you'd cycle through panels of each one of them. Wolverine's the best he is at what he does, and, you know, the various catchphrases of exposition of or description of who these characters are in a nutshell.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and that goes back to the ancient oral tradition of storytelling of, you know, Homer's Odyssey in that era, where they would be used for the orator to just use as a catchphrase as he's trying to remember what's the next part of the story or something, but also as a refrain for the audience. Oh, yeah, I know who that is.
Yeah. Well, and then there's the ones, there was a period where it almost became too cliche.
Mm-hmm.
Martha Wayne's pearls falling through the storm drain come to mind. I think every artist that's ever worked on Batman has drawn that page multiple times. Well, at least since Frank Miller did it I guess David Mazzucchelli drew it the first time.
Well, could you really consider yourself a longtime Batman artist if you hadn't drawn that?
Yeah.
Or a longtime Spider-Man artist without having drawn the flashback to Uncle Ben's death or something?
Yeah, also true.
Or Aunt May, you know, on her deathbed to some extent. There's just certain tropes or whatever for each franchise that keep coming up.
Yep.
And they work, so, you know, it makes sense. So there were a couple of points here in 144 where I felt the captions were bordering on narration in a prose novel level.
A little bit, yeah. Particularly the ones that are in the yellow boxes on a few pages.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that sequence at Notre Dame in particular.
Yeah, and it's standard for the storytelling of the era, but the amount of words per panel, you know, words on the page and stuff like that, it was just, again, different storytelling style.
Yeah.
And not good, not bad, but it does make these things, even if they're not as long of a story, take longer to read than some modern comics.
Absolutely. Well, modern comics, I do think you get those narration boxes.
Yeah.
They replace the thought balloons. And in this era, there's kind of a mix of both.
Yeah. Here we've got a narrator voice kind of speaking to us, which, you know, it's like in the old Super Friends thing, you know, meanwhile at the Hall of Justice, that sort of caption. I don't see many of those these days in comics, because it's usually some character speaking voiceover.
Yeah.
So, and there were a couple of times where there were things they could do in this era because of that that you just can't do as easily these days.
Also true.
So, I will say that this Cyclone character that he fights, I don't know if he got used much after this. I'm pretty sure the previous issue of this was his first appearance.
Okay, that makes sense.
And I'm thinking this version of the character was one of the many, many villains killed by Scourge in the Captain America series when Mark Gruenwald was doing some house cleaning.
Oh, okay. I can see that.
I was quite shocked that Spidey managed to defeat this Cyclone with, you know, wind powers with a large fan.
Why not?
Sure, it makes as much sense as anything, I guess. But it did feel like a lot of this was, you know, wrapping up the storyline from the previous issue,
mm-hmm.
and really just the prologue of events with Gwen and stuff, of, okay, she's back, and, you know, it's freaking people out.
Yeah, and, I mean, we don't get most of that until the last couple of pages.
Mm-hmm. I did feel that one of the things that was going on with these stories, and I don't know if it's something Conway usually does or not, but the last page, last scene or so, usually tended to be a bit of a bombshell story plot drop.
Yeah.
And sometimes in a, you know, you could have given this a little smoother or whatever. because the last panel where we see Gwen, it's like, okay, end on a big moment. I get it. That I agree with.
Well, it's not even that. It's Peter finding out about Aunt May from Anna Watson.
Mm-hmm.
A lot happens to Peter in that last two pages.
Well, but I guess my point is with Gwen, seeing Gwen makes sense as a story moment to put that there.
Oh, yeah.
And that we see happen, but the rest of it we're told happened.
Yeah.
About Aunt May, she's in the hospital, all this kind of stuff. And it feels like a lot of things we get throughout this are, here's story information the reader needs to have. We're running out of pages, boom, let's just hand it to them on the last page or two. And there was a little bit with that last page where Peter's just gotten out of the cab, it's taken off, he finds out Aunt May's in the hospital, so he runs up to his apartment.
Yeah.
And that the timing of that, with the way it was shown, the dialogue and stuff, it didn't work for me. He hears Aunt May's in the hospital, he should be heading out to go to the hospital. But he's halfway up the stairs as Anna Watson's telling him, you know, upstairs in your apartment, you know.
Yeah.
So he seemed to have jumped the gun on that.
Yeah. And again, like you said, earlier in this issue, we had seen the whole sequence with Aunt May and seeing someone she thinks she recognizes.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole sequence, I don't know, you can't read it without knowing at this point, but you would think if you went in totally blind, picking this up off the rack, it's very easy to see Gwen in that panel now in, you know, what is that, like page 6 or 7?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, oh, of course that's Gwen. But I don't think it's obvious if you don't know.
I don't think it would have been as obvious at that point in time, because I think as a culture, we were not as story savvy as we are today.
Fair enough.
You know, this was back in 1975. And that's not to say people were any dumber or anything like that. It's more a matter of these same sorts of story plot lines have been told time and time and time again since then.
Yeah.
That we've gotten very used to them.
Yeah.
You know, we've got a plethora of story options in books, TV shows, movies, you know, cable channels, streaming services, etc. Whereas there weren't as many stories flooding out as there were back then. As there are now, you know.
That's true. And to look at it now, there's some kind of obvious things. The blonde hair, for instance. Because without the blonde hair, you'd think it was Mary Jane. But again, why would she think that was a ghost?
Yeah, but you go back to the cover, you see the boot.
And
you can't be, you're dead or whatever.
Yeah, that is true.
So right there, it's like, okay, he's seeing somebody he recognizes and thinks is dead.
Yeah.
I don't know how big of a pool of characters that was.
Yeah, fair
enough.
Because
that's sure not Uncle Ben.
Yeah, that is true.
So.
But again, it's interesting because the way the lighting is done on that page,
mm-hmm.
with basically the yellow shadows from the windows on everything, which you can argue conceals the blonde hair, even though it makes it extremely yellow. And it's only on that page. It's only in that panel that the light is kind of shown that way.
Yeah, but you can make out what looks to be the signature hairband she always wore.
Yep.
So there's enough that if you know it's her, you can't not see it.
Absolutely.
But not having read it at the time, I don't know.
Yeah. And that's kind of, you know, that's all I'm saying. It's amazing how, I guess, fair the art was done. But, you know, if you didn't know, you could totally have missed it on that page.
Yeah, it could have been just as easy, though, for them to have said at the end, it's not a clone, it's her identical cousin or something.
Oh, absolutely.
So, yeah. But again, they showed the character more there than I think they would have today.
Yeah, that's probably true as well.
But again, a lot of this was, like I said, wrapping up the ongoing storyline and setting the seeds for her return and what's going on with that.
Yep.
And really, when we get to that next issue, that's where things really kind of, you know, kick in and whatnot. And Peter just does not take it well.
Well, and neither did Aunt May. They take it very similarly.
He probably took it a little better than she did, but he's not hospitalized, but he's, you know, this is the kind of reaction that a character in the Marvel Universe could not have today, legitimately.
Why do you say that?
What character hasn't come back from the dead?
Oh, okay, fair enough.
I mean, if you're Spider-Man, and even if you haven't hung out much with, but are familiar with the Fantastic Four, the Avengers, and the X-Men, you know, most of those have had very public deaths and resurrections since this story.
Mm-hmm.
That this whole, you know, him almost snapping because she's back from the dead and he knows she's dead, I don't think would hold water.
Yeah, fair enough.
So it's, again, just a much earlier time in the Marvel Universe, because at this point it was, you know, what, 10 years old?
Yeah.
It started in, what, 61, so 15, I guess.
Yeah.
But still, versus, you know, the many decades we've layered on since.
And it's interesting because, you know, this article, you get him and Gwen speaking and him thinking he's crazy and being angered and thinking someone's playing a joke, whatever you want to look at that whole sequence. And it's amazing how he seemingly, until he's ready to leave and head off to the hospital, almost forgets about Aunt May for,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, the first 5 to 8 pages of the story.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. It's, again, that felt a little off. I felt he should have, you know, at the end of last issue, headed off to the hospital before even stumbling across Gwen. But, you know, this was more dramatic and therefore makes sense.
Yeah.
One of the things that was puzzling me a little with this, when we introduce the villain of the story, Scorpion,
mm-hmm.
he's served out his time already.
Yes.
How short was his sentence?
Well, yeah.
Because, and I think at this point, the sliding scale of comic book timelines was just in a different state.
Yeah.
You know, these days we know publishing time does not equal elapsed time in story, you know, Savage Dragon, you know, is the exception. But at this point, you know, in the 70s, they really hadn't had enough backstory to have to really deal with that much.
Yeah, that's fair.
Because well, there are a couple of times it goes from, you know, the question of how long she's been dead shifts.
Yeah.
Because I think at one point he said it was a couple of months. Another time it's a few years. So, yeah. But I just couldn't figure out how short Scorpion's sentencing was for him to be out, even on good behavior.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. You go back to the 1966 Batman television series,
mm-hmm.
which was only on for
3 years.
Yeah, 3 years about. They still got 120 episodes in. But yes, it's amazing. And it's about 50-50. How many of them start or begin with a known villain either being released or escaping from prison? It, somehow the escaping part never seems to add to their sentence.
Yeah, yeah. But there's at least a time or two in that show where, like, the Riddler was out and not, you know, being sought to get back in jail kind of a thing.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's as good a way as any to get Scorpion back into the story, but
yep,
it did seem a little weird.
And again, now I know this. At the time, it's not until that page where he opens up the suitcase
mm-hmm.
that I realized it was the Scorpion. I didn't recognize the name Gargan or, you know, at the time, when I first read this, McDonald Gargan didn't, oh yeah, that's the Scorpion, just wasn't something I kind of had in my memory.
I recognized the name, at least as a Spider-Man villain. I was pretty sure it was Scorpion, but
yep.
But there are other ones that I might not have caught, so yeah.
Yeah.
But again, showing the suitcase and stuff, which is funny because he's taking that out of jail.
Yes.
So they hung on to his suit and gave it back to him.
Yes.
So I'm very much questioning the prison system in the Marvel Universe at this point.
Yes.
You don't have him serve much time, and you give him back his weapons at the end. Okay. But again, showing the suitcase and the outfit and stuff in there, they're playing fair. If you don't
Absolutely.
Know who he is, we'll tell you, or at least give you a clue. Well, actually, they tell us it's the Scorpion. So that's the kind of fair play storytelling that I kind of miss.
Yeah. And then, of course, Peter gets to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
We, you know, and at first, he's kind of told to calm down and allow Aunt May to rest, and then he calms down and is allowed to sit with her.
Yeah, what got me was when we then get the dream sequence kind of recap.
Oh, okay, after the Scorpion robs the bank?
Yeah, because okay, that was yeah. back when villains would actually still rob banks.
Yes.
Again, this is one of those things, though, where they devote a page of, we've gotten Gwen back, he's flipped out. We probably ought to tell you why he's flipped out.
Yeah.
I appreciate that sort of thing.
You know, absolutely. And it's a wonderful page of art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I don't know how many times Scorpion had been used at this point. because this, again, I think was still one of their earlier rematches and such. I thought the fight scene was good. It was interesting. But when we got to the point where we've got the info dump there at the end again, I'm like, what's going on with this?
Now, okay, so...
Is this the one where they kind of jumped over to in the middle where part of the story... Yeah, this is the one where
it goes to Marvel Team Up 33. Yep.
Yeah.
And you get Nighthawk. Nighthawk, yes. Yes.
I don't really like it when it's a, hey, stop reading this to go read this other story and then come back here.
Particularly when it's not either at the beginning or the end. It's like almost smack dab in the middle of this issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, if it's at the... If it takes place before an issue, they should have it the first page.
Yep.
First thing. Hey, you might want to go read this first.
Yep.
And if it's happening after the issue, they ought to end on it and go check this out next.
Yep.
But to do it in the middle of, okay, hey, stop. We're jumping past this other story we just told in this other book. You know, it's annoying. And it's one that I don't know that it added much to have it happen in the middle.
Yeah.
But it does go towards the interconnectedness of all things of the Marvel Universe at that time.
Absolutely.
And that is something I kind of miss. But given how sprawling the Marvel Universe has gotten with the number of concurrent titles and stuff, I'm kind of okay they got rid of it to the degree they had it back then.
Yeah.
You know, the stuff they were doing here, we spend a good number of pages on the fight scene.
Yeah, no, the fight scene is at least the middle half of this issue.
Yeah. But then to get back to the Gwen Stacy stuff at the end and get that info dump on that last page, you know, this is the quote-unquote real Gwen Stacy, matching fingerprints. I guess there's two, one alive, one dead. And they don't even really properly introduce Ned here.
No, Ned just kind of shows up and is like, well, we fingerprinted her. It's the real one. But there's still the dead one. And, well, yeah, we don't know. And Gwen herself doesn't seem to know.
I don't even think they name Gwen on that page. Or not Gwen, Ned.
No, I don't think they do either.
He's just a guy in a trench coat who's come up and is spouting exposition.
Yeah, but...
It becomes clearer later in the story.
Well, and it's clear. He does say she arrived at the Bugle. So, I mean, at that point, as a even part-time Spider-Man fan, it's got to be Ned.
As a longtime Spider-Man fan who is not that familiar with this era...
Fair enough.
I thought it was Ned, but I wasn't positive, because most of the time I've read, which is Black Suit on, he's not around.
Fair enough. Okay.
And he wasn't in the previous issue either, I believe. Of course, most of that was taking place in Paris.
But, okay, it's obviously not J. Jonah.
Obviously.
And it's obviously not Joe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not Betty. So at that point, it's got to be Ned.
Actually, I take it back. They do call him Ned in the second panel on that page. It's easy to miss.
So oh, upsetting words. Or Ned, what's... Okay, you're right, he does. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
But he's not as prominent a longtime supporting cast member as, you know, either Gwen, Mary Jane, Betty, or Joe.
No, absolutely. And that's the thing. I mean, yeah, it's kind of, oh, it's got to be that other guy from the Bugle because it's not Jonah and it's not Joe.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not Flash either.
Well, yeah, also true.
But that's the kind of thing. You kill the character off, and people who come on board later aren't as familiar with him.
Fair enough.
So, it just felt like that last page, though, of we've done the fingerprinting, we've checked the grave, you know, body hasn't been touched, all that. There's a lot of story stuff just dumped right there.
Especially that was kind of all done in this day.
Mm-hmm.
And this is before computer analysis. Fingerprinting would have taken 2 or 3 days and a guy with a magnifying glass staring at it for hours in these days.
Yeah, yeah. Because you're right. I mean, this is a little after sunset when he gets there.
Yeah, and she says she showed up this morning.
Yeah, so in the span of the business day, they got all that figured out and had time to go dig up the grave.
Yeah, and this was, you know, fingerprinting her is one thing. Getting a hold of the original one's fingerprints... Then getting someone who really knows what they're doing to sit there with the cards and stare at them. Not to mention, yeah, an exhumation order, not easy to get. Judges don't like digging people up.
Yeah. So I was just a little disappointed how quickly, both in story time and physical real estate on that last page, some of this was happening.
It is a big, big impact. There's no way that would have been done that way now.
No.
That could have been multiple issues right there.
Well, I think that one scene.
That's what I'm saying, that page.
Yeah, that page would have been, I think, a full issue easily. And not to the betterment of the story flow. But we would have then had time to do the flashbacks in that scene to them digging up the body, them getting the order, them checking the fingerprinting and all that stuff.
Yeah.
It is worth mentioning, though, on that second to last page, at this point, Scorpion thinks he's killed Spider-Man.
Yes, he does.
So, because when we get to that next issue, well, it's funny, I was going to say, we get Scorpion kind of, oh, I've killed Spider-Man, I'm going to be the new crime boss or whatever. But first, we spend a fair amount of time with the Jackal, and he's one that, have we even seen him before?
Who?
A Jackal. I mean, when we start on the first of page of 146.
In this story, no. In all time, absolutely. He goes all the way back to Amazing Spider-Man 31.
Ah, okay, okay.
I don't, is that Ditko still, or? Yeah, the Jackal's a Ditko character.
Okay, I wasn't sure how far back he went. Again, not that familiar with this era. Like I said, I got on with Secret Wars for most of the Marvel Universe and stuff. But to start with this character and a page or two on him and stuff, give him where we'd been leaving off, feels a little odd, but definitely makes sense given he's the guy behind the whole story. So they had to set him up in this at some point.
Yeah, let me see here. I'm trying to check on the Jackal. Yeah, not only, wow. And Miles Warren's first appearance, well, Miles Warren goes back to Spider-Man 31, which is not only the introduction of Miles Warren, it's also the introduction of Harry Osborn and Gwen Stacy.
Well, that's funny.
The Jackal doesn't show up until 129.
Okay, so after she's dead, but before this.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And I don't know if you noticed the note that this was Jerry Conway's third year on Spider-Man.
I did. They were making a bigger deal of that apparently over in Thor than here.
I didn't check Thor. Is Thor also about Mr. Conway, or is that someone else?
I don't know. I'm assuming he was doing stuff over there, too. I did think it was a bit hilarious when Scorpion breaks into the gang boss's mansion, and it's like, you know, I've killed Spider-Man. I'm now in charge, or whatever. They whip out the TV remote, turn on the 6 o'clock news, and there's Spider-Man.
Yep.
I don't know what was funnier, the fact that the timing of this was they could turn on the news and right then and there Spider-Man's on it, or the fact they did it with one of these now old school remotes with the two click button type things, you know, versus what we would think of as a modern day remote
control. Yes.
Even then, that was cutting edge technology, probably. I remember in that era, my parents had three and a half remote controls. It was me and my sisters. The youngest one, not always that good on which channel to flip to instead.
Well, I remember remotes, I want to say, had a single button, and you just kind of had to pray.
I thought it was two, one for on and one for off.
I seem to remember there was one, the television set we had as a child, that first had a remote, I think it had one button, and you could use it to turn the TV on, and it was basically the channel up button at that point, and you then, when you wanted to turn it off, had to physically push the knob back in.
Interesting, okay. Like I said, my parents used the children for that purpose.
Oh, yes.
But I did think it was funny that he goes in saying, oh, I've killed Spider-Man, and there's instant proof he hadn't.
Yes.
But where the previous issue left off, I can see him thinking that. I will say the fight scene we get briefly between the Scorpion, who's in all green, and the Jackal, who's in all green. Yeah, I mean, the art tells the story and stuff, and there's slightly different shades of green, but still, not the most colorful of fight scenes. But Jackal recruiting Scorpion at this point, I thought was interesting. I don't know how he knew to find him there.
No. Yes.
But, you know, these things happen. So, I think it was needed for those two to hook up very visibly so Scorpion could get sent after Aunt May as a way to, quote-unquote, find Spider-Man. And this is indicating the Jackal kind of knows Peter is Spider-Man, but didn't just blabbing that all over town. Little surprised Aunt May just didn't die of a heart attack right there.
Yes, well, yeah.
And we spend another couple of pages on the fight scene, and this is just different pacing than I think we'd get today.
Yeah, well, and we kind of skipped over the page where Gwen and Peter kind of talk for a minute.
Oh, yeah, earlier in the issue.
Yeah.
Yeah, Peter's still kind of working through what all is going on.
Yeah.
So, I think she's still taking everything in and stuff, too, but he just... that's got to be a rough place for Peter to be in, because his old girlfriend is asking, do you still love me?
Yep.
He's still coming to grip with, wait, you're alive.
Yes.
And is pretty much having a relationship with Mary Jane at this point.
Which is interesting. I don't think Mary Jane's in this issue.
No, but they talk about that later, how he's kind of, you know, not seen much of her lately. Or she hasn't seen much of him.
Well, of course, because he was in Europe. But she was there with Ned on that page that had everything on it and looked less than happy.
Yeah.
In the previous issue.
Understandable. Yeah, they're doing quite a bit with the plot, subplot type stuff. And you could argue which is the plot and which is the subplot.
Yeah.
I mean, they're definitely using the scorpion and stuff for the action scenes and all of that. But I think the main plot of the story throughout these issues is the whole what's going on with Gwen. And in this case, the scorpion is just a tool of the Jackal for the moment, if you will.
Absolutely.
I did find the last page where Aunt May is just lecturing Scorpion. Hilarious.
Yes. Oh, that's great. Yes. Yeah. That page is hilarious.
Yeah.
No doubt about it.
It's funny. This woman is so frail, she'll faint when she thinks she sees, I guess, a ghost or whatever, yet doesn't mind chewing out a known supervillain.
Yes. Also,
she'll probably be out of jail before too long.
Yeah. And somewhere in that fight sequence, you get something I don't think you'd see today. The whole sequence where Spider-Man basically says, you're supposed to go splat. What's wrong? You know, the idea that he essentially just threw him off a building thinking he'd die, and this Spider-Man didn't necessarily care or think that was a bad thing, which, there's a debate there. But comics somewhere in the late 80s kind of settled on heroes don't kill even bad people.
Yeah, I don't think he was aiming to kill him, but definitely did knock him off the roof.
Well, no, but he even says, you're not supposed to, you were supposed to go splat. You weren't supposed to come back.
Yeah, second to last page there, which is...
So yeah, that's, again, just a difference in modern comics.
It's hard to say how much of that is he actually felt that or was just quipping as Spider-Man is wont to do.
Fair enough.
It could be read either way, and I'm not sure which is the right read.
That's a fair argument, too.
So, not, I think, one of the Scorpion's best appearances, but not bad.
No.
And moving on to the last one we'll cover in this episode is Amazing Spider-Man 147, where we get the Tarantula. It's kind of a cool-looking character, although the boots are with the razor-sharp spikes are insane. But you've got one spider guy in blue and red fighting another spider guy in blue and red. So, again, I'm not sure what the colorists thought of these stories these days. This story takes place after giant-sized Spider-Man number 5 with some sort of adventure with the Man-Thing.
That is, yep.
And Tarantula was last seen, according to the footnotes, in Spider-Man 135.
Which is shortly after he only first appeared in, somewhere around there.
I was going to say 131, 132, I think.
Yeah, fair enough. It's somewhere in there.
What I don't exactly understand is how, one, why the prison has a shoe shop, two, why it has the equipment needed to make razor-sharp spike shoes, and then when he breaks out on that next page, he's doing it with what looks like a blowtorch or something to cut the bars.
Yes.
So, again, not having the faith in the prison system here that I'd like to. And then the perfect timing for the Jackal to have picked him up in the van with, it looks like, a trick collapsing roof or something?
Sure. Why not? Yeah, it's got trap doors, that's for sure.
Yeah. Again, this is at least a guy breaking out of jail versus just getting out on good behavior, so we'll give him something for that.
Well, and they specifically tell you he's serving a 20-year to life sentence.
Which seems way longer than whatever Scorpion had to have gotten.
Yes.
So maybe they realize they really need to crack down on these supervillains and have been cranking up the sentencing ever since. We do get a really nice scene as Aunt May's getting out of the hospital with her and Mary Jane and, you know, Mary Jane's worrying about her relationship with Peter and such.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think if this, maybe it was in one of the later issues where she's talking about how she's barely seen Peter since Gwen came back. No,
yes.
It's here. I haven't seen Peter once. It's like he's forgotten I exist. But definitely, I think, a good scene between those two. Nice to see kind of a flashback image of a young Uncle Ben.
Yeah.
Not something you see that often. And then when we get to Spidey, you know, swinging around or whatever, he's flashing back to a lab report he got from Ned that we never actually saw, but presumably was that scene in the hospital.
Mm.
Or some other point. I don't know.
I thought, yeah, I mean, we did see him hand it to him, right?
I didn't even see a file in that scene at
So you go back the hospital. Go back to the shoe shop page.
Oh, the shoe shop page. You're right. Hang on.
At the very top of that page, he's telling him, listen, this is Gwen Stacy thing. I've done some checking.
You're right.
Maybe so you should read it yourself.
File then, and I guess he's reading it between then and swinging around.
Yeah.
Yeah, a fair amount of this is happening off panel. This is what gives me the feeling of we're being told a bit more of the story than we're being shown.
Yeah.
Because he's clearly had time to read it and, oh, she's some sort of a clone. And they have to explain what a clone is at this point.
Well, of course.
And again, that's the difference between then and now. That was, you know, high-tech sci-fi or whatever. Whereas now, I'm not going to say it's science fact or whatever, to at least the degree they use it here, but we understand what a clone is.
Well, like you pointed out, there have been a lot more stories with them, plus the actual biological innovations that have led to forms of cloning.
Well, and let's face it, if there are two pieces of science a longtime Spider-Man fan is going to be aware of, radioactive spiders, and because of this story and subsequent stories, clones.
Absolutely.
Everything else, I mean, robotics for Doc Ock and a few other things, yeah, sure, but not anywhere near as important as those two. It does seem like Spidey is still having some issues dealing with Gwen's death and resurrection or whatnot.
Well, of course, and, you know, and again, possibly playing with the times and what the reader would have thought, as he begins contemplating the possibilities of cloning, that also bothers him, which is understandable.
Yeah, even at this point, it's understandable. Later, way more understandable.
Exactly.
Yeah, and then Tarantula has been sent out, presumably by the Jackal, to go fight Spidey. And again, we get some good stuff here. Again, the red and blue versus red and blue color scheme, a little kind of funny, but it works. And the spike shoes, I'm still having a hard time with that. I would love to see Tarantula team up with Batroc the Leaper. Whatever you do, don't let them kick you.
But, I mean, that was his thing.
Yeah, absolutely. It was his gimmick, just like the Scorpion's got the tail and stuff like that. And they stick to it.
Yep.
Now, one question I've got for you is around this point in the story, when the two are fighting, we're doing it in traffic.
Yep.
We get the two kids in the bus. We get, I thought there was another couple in the taxi. There were a couple where I'm wondering, should we have recognized these people?
I don't think so. There's the couple in the car that gets hit by the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the two kids that in the bus that kind of end up in the middle of the fight and we see them escape.
In both cases, they get named.
Yeah, they do.
We get Mabel and Herman from Detroit and Hyman and Bernie. So I wasn't sure, were they from TV shows at the time or some other cultural reference that they would do sometimes that is just lost on me, you know, decades later?
If so, I'm not familiar with it.
Okay, fair enough. Just thought I'd ask.
Yep, no, absolutely.
The Jackal, who is in a costume to look like the Jackal, although that wasn't immediately clear, wearing a costume to look like a bus driver on top of that, little weird, but okay. Not sure how the Jackal ears squish down to fit in the bus driver mask?
Yeah.
Okay. Some of this you just got to kind of go with. I did think that the drug tip on the spike shoes, not totally playing fair for the Jackal, but okay. And I'm not up on my New York geography and stuff. At this point, we're at the Brooklyn Bridge. I'm pretty sure they said it was a different bridge that Gwen had gotten thrown off of. But I think that was deemed to have been misnamed at the time. So I'm not sure what was going on with that. But to end this issue with Spidey chained up at the top of the same bridge that Gwen had died from and getting thrown off just like she'd kind of gotten thrown off minus the chains and stuff, definitely good cliffhanger ending.
Absolutely.
Now, the Jackal refers to Gwen's death as being 2 years ago, back in one...
Peter had said months when he saw her first.
Yeah, back in 145. But I think in 146, Jackal had also referenced the murder as 2 years ago. as did Gwen. So again, the sliding time scale of comics just hadn't been figured out at that point. Do you go with how long it's been story time? Do you go with how long it's been publishing time? And there's no good answer.
Yeah.
So, I mean, at this point in the story, we've got Gwen, we've introduced the concept of clones, but I think things are still just getting rolling and such. And it's very much, particularly when we cut over to Giant-Sized Spider-Man or the Marvel Team-Up 33 or whatever it was, a day in the life of Spider-Man series.
Yeah.
You know, you feel you're following this character as his journey is going on versus so many modern stories where we're just telling you an adventure and we'll tell you another adventure. Maybe time elapsed in between. Maybe it didn't. Who knows? Who cares? Or these characters are in 15 places at once and that makes no sense.
Yes. Well, and I think the second issue, what was that, 145 we did today, is the one where they specifically give you a time reference like that. Because I believe when Peter's sitting on the steps there, kind of mad at Gwen, doesn't it say, you know, minute after our last issue or something?
Yeah, there are a couple of times this takes place just seconds after we left off kind of thing.
Yeah.
So they're very much trying to bridge that gap between and fit in Spidey's other adventures and other books.
Yeah.
And that's when they took the time to do that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of what made comics of that era feel more cohesive and the universe more cohesive and the characters more real, is there was an actual timeline of events. I mean, maybe it was a little unclear at times as to exactly when certain things happened, but you knew that there was a sensibility to it, even if you didn't totally understand it.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with that.
So I feel they covered quite a bit of ground in this stuff, and there's a definite story density here that's typical of the time and gives them the ability to you know, be telling the, here's what's going on with Gwen and Peter, here's what's going on with Spidey and the Jackal, oh, by the way, Mary Jane's having some stuff going on, and, you know, same with Aunt May. Again, they cover a ton of ground.
They absolutely do. And, I mean, we've covered four issues, and so much has happened.
Yeah.
I mean, we were in Peter with Jonah and Cyclone, and here we are with Peter being thrown off the bridge by the Jackal and a clone Gwen Stacy and the Tarantula, and lest forget, the Scorpion was captured in the middle of this as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and the villains will show up for an issue or two, versus today they'll be around for six.
That is true. With that, the exception of the one who's in all of them.
Well, the Jackal and stuff, but I mean, there's still...
But he's not even introduced until... I mean, the Scorpion's out and robbing banks in it before we even meet the Jackal.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But even if you've got one that's behind the scenes, as would, like, Kingpin would sometimes be in some various books or whatever, there's still the who am I fighting today aspect.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, and doing a fight, hero loses, let's have the rematch next issue, pretty standard and acceptable storytelling. Anything else on these four issues?
No, I'm good.
All right, then we'll come back and do the next four next time.
Yes, sir.
Cool. Recording clips for the preview spotlight episodes is easy, and we've got an open submission policy for these episodes. Please send in clips to support the comics you love as often as you can. If you'd like to get email reminders for the preview spotlight episodes, you can join the emailing list on the main page of the comicbookpage.com website. The deadline is typically the second Saturday of the month at 9 a.m. Check the main page of the website for more information and the exact deadline for the next preview spotlight. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.